Okay, let's keep pressing on here. Number four, texts. Texts. Which Gospels are authentic? Which Gospels should we view as being in the canon of the New Testament? You know, when I open up my Bible, it says Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Wait a minute. Why were those four put in? Aren't there other Gospels that should have been put in? Why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Who made that decision? How do we know that those are the best ones to represent the life of Christ? Well, I'll start off with a fictional explanation of this. This is Sir Lee Teabing. He looks very professorly there. This is from the book, The Da Vinci Code. It's on page 231. Which one was he, Professor X or is Magneto? Yeah. All right. He says on page 231, this character, fictional character, more than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament, and yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them. There were actually 80 Gospels. And in the 4th century, according to Dan Brown's fictional story, which became very popular, and which people believed was nonfiction, according to his story, there were 80 Gospels, and in the Council of Nicaea, these early Christian leaders got together and they picked out Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John because it described Jesus as divine and it propagated their doctrine. And so goes the claim of the Da Vinci Code. However, Elaine Pagels, a New Testament critic, she's very much into Gnosticism and the Gnostic Gospels, probably the foremost scholar in this area. She writes, "We now begin to see what we call Christianity actually represents only a small selection of specific sources chosen from among dozens of others." So, yeah, you're Christian. You believe Jesus was God. He rose from the dead, that you can be forgiven of your sins. Yeah, well, those were just some of the books that were around at the time. They were chosen from among dozens of others. The concerns of Gnostic Christians survived only as a suppressed current, like a river driven underground. Actually, in her books on this, she describes that the disciples of John, the Johannine community, his disciples were tougher than Thomas's disciples. And so Thomas was coming through with his Gospel of Thomas, and John's disciples had John's Gospel. And it was like, you know, an old-fashioned street fight, you know, where it's like, we're going to push our Gospel and you guys have to go to another town. And they were suppressed. And really, it was Thomas's Gospel that was earlier than John's Gospel. Well, let's give a comparison. Let's compare the four Gospels to the Gospel of Thomas. Now, I'm trying to be fair here. Of all the other Gospels that are out there that we found, the Gospel of Thomas is the earliest. It goes back, some critics say it goes back as early as 150 A.D. Some say 120. It's the earliest Gospel. It's probably the best one to pick from to place up against the four Gospels. So we're going to pick the best of the Gnostic Gospels, the non-biblical ones, and let's compare them with the four Gospels. And we'll look at four points of comparison. Number one, the four Gospels were written earlier. Now, the Gospel of Thomas was written in AD 150, second century at least. And the four Gospels were written in the first century, far earlier. We've already demonstrated that the four Gospels were written earlier. Gospel of Thomas has to be written second century. It's actually, if you read the Gospel of Thomas, it's written in Coptic, not Greek. That demonstrates that this must have been away from the time and place of Christ. Secondly, the four Gospels mention people, places, and events. Are we just being hopelessly biased? You know, we like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we don't like the Gospel of Thomas? No. They were written earlier, and secondly, they mention people, places, and events. Let me read you the first line of the Gospel of Thomas. This is the very first line. "These are the secret sayings which the living Jesus spoke and which Didymus, Judas, Thomas wrote down." And then the rest of the Gospel of Thomas is 114 lines. That's all the bigger that it is. And it goes on to just list Jesus' teachings. It doesn't mention cities. It doesn't mention places. It hardly mentions people. It mentions Peter and a few others. So in other words, this is a second century document. Doesn't mention people, places, or events other than the disciples. And it says, well, these are the secret sayings that we've uncovered from Jesus. Now, if you were around at the time, you'd think that's nonsense, that these would just arise out of nowhere. Now, let's compare that 114 lines of just sayings from the second century with just one verse from the Gospel of Luke. In Luke chapter 3, verse 1, Luke mentions 15 details that have been corroborated extra-biblically, outside of the Bible. Let's read. Now, in the 15th year, number one, of two, Tiberius Caesar, when three, Pontius Pilate, was four, governor of five, Judea, and six, Herod, was seven, tetrarch of eight, Galilee, and his nine, brother, was ten, Philip, and was 11, tetrarch of the region of 12, Iturea and Trachonitis. Maybe that's actually 12 and a half. And 13, Lysanias was 14, tetrarch of 15, Abilene. All 15 of these details have been corroborated extra-biblically. Now, if you're a historian, which documents would you prefer? The one which has 114 lines of just sayings, or the one that mentions people, places, and events, just one verse out of which mentions 15 extra-biblical details? Okay, here's critic Bart Ehrman. We've already pointed out this guy's not a believer. He writes this: in sum, there does not appear to be much information about the historical Jesus outside the canon of the New Testament. I should stress that this conclusion is not based on a theological judgment about the supreme importance of the New Testament. He's referring, of course, to the New Testament documents versus the Gnostic Gospels and these other extra-biblical accounts. He says, we shouldn't view those as history. He says, this isn't a theological judgment. I'm an atheist, okay? I'm not saying it's one way or the other. It's just, if you want to get historical facts, you got to stick with the New Testament documents. Ehrman writes, it's a judgment that anyone who looks carefully at the historical record would have to draw, whether Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, agnostic, or atheist. No matter how you slice it, you have to rely on the New Testament if you want to know about the life of the historical Jesus. And he's referring, of course, with the New Testament documents and these extra-biblical accounts, not the extra-biblical history that mention Jesus. We're going to get to that later. The context in this section of his book, Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet, is talking about the New Testament documents versus Thomas and Peter and these other ones. Thirdly, the four Gospels have a high view of women. Four Gospels have a high view of women. Now, you're probably thinking to yourself, well, are you saying you just prefer the four Gospels because they elevate women? No, this is actually an argument for dating the New Testament documents back to the life of Christ. Let me read you a passage. I believe this is from line 114 of the Gospel of Thomas. Simon Peter said to them, "Make Mary leave us, for females don't deserve life." Now, if you remember Simon Peter from the Gospels, you think, well, you know, Jesus is probably going to correct him. No. Jesus affirms what he says. He says, look, Peter, I will guide her to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every female who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. So here we have Jesus advocating that women get sex changes to become men so that they inherit the kingdom. Do we really think that Jesus was advocating sex changes here? Well, ask yourself a question. In the New Testament Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Jesus teaches women, Mary and Martha and a slew, a whole cadre of other women. He has women disciples, Luke 8. He consorts with women who are prostitutes. Women are the ones who are at the cross with him while all of his pansy disciples run for it. Women are the first ones at the tomb. Women are in the upper room in Acts 1 among the 120 disciples. Jesus was a rabbi who had women disciples. Can you fathom how odd that would be? Now ask yourself a question. Which picture of Jesus was more likely to have been invented by men in the first and second century? Men in the first and second century, Palestinian Judaism, were against women. They're anti-women. Josephus records, "Let not the testimony of a woman be used in a court of law." The Talmud, extra-biblical Jewish commentary, said, "Better that the law be burned than put into the hands of a woman." That was the lay of the land at the time. Which group would be more likely to be pro-women and which would be likely to be anti-woman? Gospel of Thomas just blends in with the other people at the time. And then fourthly, the four Gospels were quoted by the early Christian community. So the four Gospels were written almost 100 years earlier. They mention people, places, and events that can be corroborated extra-biblically. They have a high view of women, which was odd for the time and place. And fourthly, they were quoted by the early Christian community. The pre-Nicene church fathers quote all but 11 verses of the New Testament. Well, how does that square with this idea that the church fathers in the Council of Nicaea, 325, created the New Testament documents? Well, it doesn't square at all. Before Nicaea ever happened, all of these early Christian leaders quoted the New Testament so many times that you could reconstruct the entire thing except for 11 verses. In J.P. Moreland's book, Scaling the Secular City, he says that they quote the New Testament 32,000 times. They're all over the New Testament. And yet they don't quote the Gnostic Gospels. But they only quote the New Testament documents. Here's the way William Lane Craig describes it. This is from Reasonable Faith, page 258. He says, "It is a simple fact that with one exception, no apocryphal gospel is ever even quoted by any known author during the first 300 years after Christ." I think that exception is either a commentary on the revelation of Peter or quoting the Gospel of Thomas. I can't remember which one, but there's one exception where a guy before Nicaea quotes a non-canonical book outside of the New Testament. However, that's the only exception. He writes, "In fact, there is no evidence that any inauthentic gospel existed in the first century in which all four gospels and Acts were written. The apocryphal gospels were never quoted, were not read in Christian assemblies, were not collected into a volume, were not listed in the catalogs, were not noticed by Christianity's adversaries, were not appealed to by heretics, and were not the subject of commentaries or collations, but were nearly universally rejected by Christian writers of succeeding ages. Even the enemies of Christianity didn't quote from these books. These were universally rejected. There was no cloak and dagger meeting at the Council of Nicaea where a bunch of evil men got together and picked the books out. These were being quoted, used, and widespread, and they didn't quote from these other books." Number five, trivial details. Trivial details. Are the facts accurate? When we look at the kind of inconsequential, trivial details, kind of those throwaway comments that are made in the New Testament, are they verifiable? Can they be corroborated outside of the New Testament? Well, let's narrow in on the book of Acts. Let's look at the book of Acts. Colin J. Heimer, in his very powerful book, The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History, this came out about 10 years ago, went through the book of Acts with a fine-tooth comb. And he looked at every specific historical detail that Luke mentioned. And he went through and saw if it could be corroborated, if it could be backed up outside of the Bible. This is what Hemer writes on page 107. He says, Luke appears in general to be careful rather than careless in his rendering of commonplaces. This type of evidence suggests some controls on the kind of person we conceive Luke to have been. Luke had an attention to detail that was just second to none. Hemer goes on to point out about 180 what he calls, quote, undesigned coincidences on page 104. These are 180 details, roughly, that Luke got right. And don't even bother writing these down. We're going to fly through them. Luke knows that Emperor Augustus's name and his title were written differently. Luke knows specific knowledge of Jerusalem's territory and topography, Acts 1:12. Luke knows that Anna still had prestige in Jerusalem even after Caiaphas takes over after him, Acts 4:6. Annas was the high priest after Caiaphas, but he knew that Caiaphas still had his fingers in power at that time. Acts 12:4, Luke knows details about the military guard. Acts 13:7, Luke knows the name of the correct proconsul at Paphos. Acts 17:1, Luke knows the resting places for a voyage from Philippi to Thessalonica, Amphipolis and Apollonia. Acts 27-28, Luke knows geography and navigational details about the voyage to Rome. Luke correctly names river ports, Acts 13:13, coasting ports, Acts 14:25, and seaports, Acts 16:11, for Paul's travels. He knew not only where Paul went, but he could name the ports as Paul went along. Acts 14:6, Luke knows that Iconium was considered a city in Phrygia rather than Lacedaemon. You know, the boundaries for these territories were redrawn later on in history. It would be like if Cincinnati was annexed by Kentucky or something like that. And yet we knew that at this time, Cincinnati was still in Ohio. He knew that Iconium was in that section rather than another. Acts 14:11, Luke knows the native language spoken in Lystra, which was unusual in a major cosmopolitan city. It was a very diverse city, and yet he knew the language there. Acts 14:12, Luke knows the common worship in Lystra. Acts 16:13, Luke knows that the river Gangitis flows close to the walls of Philippi. Acts 16:14, Luke knows that Thyatira is a center of dyeing, which has been confirmed by a number of inscriptions. Acts 17:6, Luke knows that the magistrates were called polytarchs, plural. This would be like if a historian 500 years from now found a document that said, yes, the presidents of the United States both made a decision. Luke said that there were polytarchs, plural, in this city. Well, critics for years just excoriated Luke's historicity on this point until they uncovered documentation which showed that in this narrow time window there were two polytarchs in the city, not one, which was highly uncommon. Acts 17:17, Luke knows that there was an agora, or a big convention stadium, in Athens where philosophical debate was popular. Acts 17:18, Luke knows that it was common Athenian slang to call someone a babbler in Athens. That was a specific slang you would use in that territory at that time. Acts 17:23, Luke knows that altars to unknown gods were mentioned. Acts 17:28, Luke knows that Epimenides, showing that Paul was familiar with current Athenian religion. Epimenides is part of Diogenes' story about unknown gods. Acts 17:32, Luke knows that Athenians were hostile to the concept of resurrection, which they were. Acts 18:2, Luke knows that Claudius' expulsion of the Jews from Rome, placing it in the proper time frame. He mentions it at the exact time that it happened. Acts 18:12, Luke knows the name of the proconsul at Corinth. Acts 19:19, Luke knows the local philosopher in Ephesus was named Tyrannus. Acts 19:24, Luke knows about the shrines of Artemis. Many of these have been uncovered. Acts 19:27, Luke knows the expression, quote, the great goddess Artemis. This was an expression used at the time. Acts 19:29, Luke knows of the historic Ephesian theater. Acts 19:35, Luke knows the correct title for the chief magistrate in Ephesus. Acts 19:38, Luke knows that there were two proconsuls in Ephesus instead of one. Acts 20, 4 through 5, Luke knows the typical ethnic names. 20, 14 through 15, Luke knows the exact sequence of places in their travel and gets them right in the proper sequence. Acts 21, 3, Luke knows and adds eyewitness comments and portions of the voyage. Yes, we were sailing near Malta and it came along the east side or the west. Acts 23, 2, Luke knows the high priest Ananias, places him in the correct time period. Acts 23, 24, Luke knows the governor Felix, places him in the correct time period. 25, 5, Luke knows common Roman court procedure. He knows what it was like to be in court at that time. Acts 24, 27, Luke knows the successor of Felix, Porcius Festus. 25, 13, Luke knows of King Agrippa II. 27, 8, Luke knows of a poorly sheltered roadstead on the way to Rome. He knew where to stop to get a drink on the way. Luke is familiar with intricate details of ancient sailing, particularly in this region. Acts 27. Acts 28, 15, Luke is familiar with the names of the stopping places along the Appian Way on the way to Rome. Boy, what a mouthful. That's not all of the 180 details Luke gets right. It's for this reason that the old historian and archaeologist, Sir William Ramsay, he was at the end of the 19th century. This is when German higher criticism was at its zenith. It was very popular to come after the Bible for being just a book of myths. Well, Sir William Ramsay, who was an archaeologist at the time, went on an expedition in order to prove that Luke didn't write this book until AD 150 and that this was a bunch of fairy tales and Luke was a bad historian. After 30 years of investigation, Sir William Ramsay became a Christian. Far from proving that the Bible was bull, Ramsay actually went through one case after another where he found that Luke was right in very specific, insignificant details. This is what he says in his book, St. Paul the Traveler and Roman Citizen. He says, quote, I began with a mind unfavorable to it, that is the book of Acts, for the ingenuity and apparent completeness of the Tubingen theory, critical theory, had at one time quite convinced me. He was raised under this Tubingen school, higher criticism. He thought the Bible was late dated and completely wrong. Well, he writes, it did not lie then in my line of life to investigate the subject minutely. But more recently, I found myself often brought into contact with the book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities, and society of Asia Minor. He said, sometimes when I'm looking at the ancient documents, I had to go with the book of Acts as actually being the correct authority on what was happening. It was gradually borne in upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvelous truth. In fact, beginning with the fixed idea that the work, the book of Acts, was essentially a second century composition and never relying on its evidence as trustworthy for first century conditions, I gradually came to find it a useful ally in some obscure and difficult investigations. He would go into the specific details and he would try and figure out where places and people were, and he would think, what did Luke write? Well, he says it was here. Well, let me see if it's there. And he would go to that place, sure enough, right there, just as Luke said. To conclude, he writes this, Luke's historicity is unsurpassed in respect to its trustworthiness. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians. That was Ramsay's conclusion. More recently, A.N. Sherwin White, who is a Roman scholar who got into New Testament study, these are from his Sarum lectures, he writes, quote, for Acts, the confirmation of historicity is overwhelming. Any attempt to reject its basic historicity, even in matters of detail, must now appear absurd. Roman historians have long taken it for granted. That's the book of Acts. I wish we could go into the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John has been terrorized for it being a second century document, that it wasn't written by an eyewitness. And yet John, in recent years, we found that he has sometimes more historical detail than any of the other Gospels, mentioning eyewitness details. Well, we don't have enough time for tonight. Let's move on into our sixth T, testimonies. You ever ask yourself the question, what would we know about Jesus if the New Testament never existed? Was Jesus ever mentioned outside of the New Testament? If he really led a worldwide movement out of Jerusalem in the first century, wouldn't some extra biblical non-Christian historians, wouldn't they have mentioned him? Well, in this section, we're going to go through and look at all of the non-Christian, hostile historians who mentioned Jesus and what they said about him. Let's start with Cornelius Tacitus. He wrote right around 110. He writes in his Annals in chapter 15, verse 44, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace." The term Christian just means little Christ. Well, this is backed up in Acts 11:26, where it says that in Antioch, they were first called Christians. This was the title that followers of Christ gave themselves. Well, Tacitus, a non-Christian, says that Nero, this emperor, came through and tortured these Christians. He says, "Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty." So we've got these Christians. Well, where'd they come from? Well, Tacitus says they came from this guy named Christus. And he says that Christus suffered the extreme penalty. Well, remember, last week we studied the extreme penalty was crucifixion. That was the worst penalty you could be given as a Roman, or anyone else for that matter, under the rule of Rome. Tacitus writes, "During the reign of Tiberius, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilatus, and a most mischievous superstition." Okay, so what's he saying? During the reign of Tiberius, who reigned sometime between 26 and 37, and Pilate, who reigned the same time in this area, he was the governor in Judea, a most mischievous superstition arose. Pontius Pilatus is also mentioned extra-biblically on an inscription. James Hoffmeyer, an archaeologist, writes this, quote, "In 1961, a partial inscription bearing his name was discovered in Palestine, which reads, Pontius Pilate, prefect or governor of Judea." So not only does Tacitus mention that Pilate was the governor of Judea, but we also have an inscription that was found back in the 60s saying the same exact thing. Well, let's go on. Tacitus says that there was this superstition that was checked for a moment, but again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil. Gary Habermas thinks that this might be a vague reference to the resurrection. That this thing was checked for a moment. He was put down, and yet it again broke out afterwards. He says, I don't want to push that too far, but it's possible that could be kind of a vague reference to the resurrection. Not that Tacitus believes that, but that this whole thing was described in that way. He says that this wasn't only in Judea, but it made its way to Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. Is this guy a Christian? He refers to Christianity as hideous and shameful, okay? But he says that this message about Christus, who was crucified under Pontius Pilate, made its way all the way to Rome, just as the book of Acts records. Accordingly, writes Tacitus, an arrest was first made of all who pled guilty. Then upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted. Okay, you've got Tacitus writing from Rome saying Christians have made it there by AD 110. And how many are there? Well, he says, quote, an immense multitude was caught and convicted. That's how many we're talking about. There's all these Christians. We're just steeped in Christians up here. That's how many there are. Not so much for the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Well, what happened in, I believe it was 64 AD, there was a great fire that swept through Rome. And Nero, who was the emperor at the time, who died in 67, didn't want to be personally blamed by the Roman citizens for this fire. So there was this new group of people that arose at this time, named Christians, and Nero placed this crime of firing the city onto them. That's how he could justify rounding them up and murdering them and torturing them in this way. It says that he covered these Christians with the skins of beasts. They were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt, to serve as a nightly illumination when daylight had expired. Tacitus says that Nero had these Christians nailed up on crosses around his garden, and he would go inside and have garden parties, and when the sun went down, he would light the crosses on fire. And they would be kind of torches that served to light up his party. You have burning Christians on the outside of your soiree. Well, that's Tacitus. What about Pliny the Younger? This is from an excerpt from his 10th book, written right around AD 110, to the Roman Emperor Trajan, who had taken over at that time. This is a personal letter written to him. He writes this to Trajan: "It is a rule, sir, which I inviolably observe, to refer myself to you in all my doubts, for who is more capable of guiding my uncertainties?" Kind of flattering this emperor, okay? "Having never been present at any trials of the Christians, I am unacquainted with the method and limits to be observed, either in examining or punishing them." So he says, you know, "Trajan, I know you punish Christians regularly. You know, I've never been there myself when we torture them, but I don't know what the limit should be. I don't know what the method should be. Should we crucify them? How far should we attack them? I'm writing to find that out." He says, you know, "Whether difference is to be allowed between the youngest and the adult. Should we kill the old Christians or just the Christian kids? Which ones? Whether repentance admits to a pardon, or if a man has once been a Christian, it avails him nothing to recant." So, you know, should we torture them? If they say, "I'll stop following Christ," should we still kill them? You know, once a Christian, always a Christian. Or if they deny Christ, should we just give it up? He's writing about how much we should torture these people. He says, "Whether the mere profession of Christianity, albeit without crimes or only the crimes associated therewith, are punishable, in all these points, I'm greatly doubtful. Could you help illuminate this for me? Should we destroy these Christians? How much should we torture them?" They affirmed, however, the whole of their guilt or their error was that they were in the habit of meeting on a certain fixed day before it was light. Christians used to meet in the morning when it was dark so that they could be under the cover of darkness so they wouldn't get caught. When they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to a God and bound themselves by a solemn oath. So they were singing these songs to Christ as though he was still alive, even though he was dead. He says, as though this Christ was like God, and they bound themselves by a solemn oath, not to any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, never to falsify their word, nor deny a trust when they should be called upon to deliver it up. Wouldn't you love it if one of your enemies said this about you? This is a really moral group of people. You know, they don't do any wicked deeds. They don't commit fraud, theft. They don't sleep around with other people's wives. They're true to their word. This is an enemy of Christianity saying this. Well, he says, after which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food. Now, he says, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. Now, the ancient Romans used to think that Christians were cannibals and incestuous. They thought they were cannibals because they were eating the body and blood of Christ. So they thought this was like a cannibal cult where you're eating Christ's blood. They thought they were incestuous because they would only marry a brother or sister in Christ. They wouldn't marry people outside the household of the faith. Well, he says they get together and they eat this food, but notice how he says, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. They weren't eating people in there. Even this practice, however, they abandoned after the publication of my edict, by which, according to your orders, I had forbidden political associations. I judged so much the more necessary to extract the real truth. With the assistance of torture from two female slaves who were styled deaconesses. Female leadership in this early church. Interesting point. But I could discover nothing more than a depraved and excessive superstition. Is this guy a believer? No. He's talking about how much should I torture the kids versus the adults. I was torturing two Christian women. And, you know, really all I found was a depraved and excessive superstition. These people were just really excessive. They were over the top. Can't believe that they're involved in this that much. This guy is not a believer, and yet he explains all of these core details about Christianity. Well, he says, for the matter seemed to me well worth referring to you, especially considering the numbers endangered. Persons of all ranks and ages, of both sexes, this wasn't like a male thing, male and female, are and will be involved in the prosecution. We've got people of all ranks, all ages, both sexes. For this contagious superstition is not confined only to the cities, but is spread through the villages and rural districts. It seems possible, however, to check and cure it. Boy, he couldn't have been any more wrong if he tried. But that's what he thought. We can stop this. We can put a tourniquet on this bleed, and we won't let them get out any farther. He calls it a contagious superstition in Rome by AD 110. It's interesting. Tacitus called it the same thing. An immense multitude of Christians, or a contagious superstition. What about Suetonius? Suetonius, born in 69 AD, roughly to 160. This is from his book, The Life of Claudius. Suetonius writes this, because the Jews at Rome caused continuous disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he, Emperor Claudius, expelled them from the city. Well, this is backed up in Acts 18 at the exact same time, 54 AD. But wait a minute, he says the instigation of Crestus, not Christus. Christus was the Latin rendering of Christ. But he says Crestus here. Did he get that wrong? Well, let's flip over to our critic, Bart Ehrman. Ehrman explains, quote, this kind of spelling mistake was common. We have in Craig Blomberg's book, From Pentecost to Patmos, he says, regarding this quotation, most historians, think that Suetonius' statement reflects a garbled reference to Christian and non-Christian Jews squabbling over the truth of the gospel. Apparently they were fighting over this. The instigation of Crestus means that the Jewish Christians who were believers in Jesus and the non-Christian Jews were arguing over who Jesus was. Well, Claudius just kicked them all out of Rome. He said, you can all get out. And only Gentile believers in Jesus were left. Well, Suetonius writes, this is in his book, The Life of Nero. He says, after the great fire at Rome, punishments were also inflicted on the Christians, a sect professing a new and mischievous religious belief. This guy isn't a believer either, but he's corroborating the biblical account that Christianity had made its way to Rome by 54 AD and was such a widespread, ubiquitous problem in Rome that the emperor himself had to write an edict to kick every last Jew out of Rome. That's how fast and how widespread Christianity was in just 20 years. That's what he's describing there. This is a widespread movement. Okay, what about Josephus? Josephus, this is from his Antiquities of the Jews. This is in chapter 20. I want you to remember that. Antiquities, chapter 20. He writes, quote, the judges of the Sanhedrin, which was the 70 or 71 person Supreme Court in Judea. It was 70 Pharisees, and then you had the high priest reigning over it, so 71. Brought before them a man named James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, and certain others. Remember we said Luke didn't record James, the brother of Jesus' death? Josephus records it. That's how popular he was at the time. James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, and certain others. So they brought James in front of the Sanhedrin, the kind of Supreme Court at the time. Josephus writes, he accused them of having transgressed the law and delivered them to be stoned. That's the high priest speaking of these Christians. Those of the inhabitants of the city who were considered the most fair-minded and who were strict in observance of the law were offended at this. So James, the brother of Jesus, was sent away to be killed for believing in his brother Jesus. And they were saying, you're transgressing the law by preaching about your brother. And he was killed. Now, Origen, who is a third century church father, quoted this passage in Josephus. Okay, Josephus wrote this in about, let's just say, 100 A.D. But he wrote that Josephus was not a believer. He didn't say Jesus was the Christ. He said Jesus who is called the Christ. However, with this kind of quick and passing reference in chapter 20, it makes us wonder if maybe Jesus was mentioned earlier in Josephus's work. James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, is kind of a quick throwaway comment. Makes us wonder, in chapter 20, maybe he referenced Jesus earlier in the same book. Well, this is disputed by historians. Let me read the passage that we have passed down to us from Josephus, chapter 18, two chapters earlier. Okay? Chapter 18. Josephus writes this. Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man. For he was one who wrought surprising feats. He was the Christ. So what's Josephus saying? He did miracles. It's hard to even call him a man. He was the Messiah. He appeared to his disciples, to them, alive again the third day. As the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. What do you think? OK, Josephus wasn't a believer, but this is written in chapter 18. He's calling him something more than a man, a miracle worker rising on the third day, foretold in the Old Testament. Well, most historians don't believe that this is exactly from Josephus's pen. They think that this is what's called a Christian interpolation. A Christian scribe probably found Josephus's work and interpolated, put in these certain details about Christ in this section. Okay. Now, in the 4th century, Eusebius, a Christian historian, quoted from this passage. So this interpolation, if that's what's happened, which I think that is what happened, must have happened before the 4th century. Must have happened pretty early after Josephus. Well, the question arises then, does this mean that we should just throw out this section altogether? Should we just get rid of this section because many historians and even Christian historians believe that this was interpolated? Well, the answer is no. What we should do is we should revise this section. In chapter 18, we can actually revise it to show what Josephus most likely originally wrote. There's a Hebrew scholar named Shlomo Pines in 1972. He found an Arabic manuscript that's a different translation of Josephus's work that might be the revision that many historians think was original to Josephus. So let me read this for you. This is the revised version that's been translated by Pines. At this time, there was a wise man who was called Jesus. His conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and other nations became his disciples. Now, that seems like it would come from Josephus's pen. His conduct was good. He was known to be virtuous. I don't think he was virtuous. He was just known to be that way. Pilate condemned him to be crucified to die. But those who had become his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. He's not putting his neck on the line. He doesn't say that he believes in Jesus, only that some people did. Then he writes, they reported that he had appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and that he was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah concerning whom the prophets have recounted wonders. So this revised version might be, in fact, close to the original, before it was tampered with. that it's not that he actually believed these things, but that's just what they're saying, that he rose from on the third day. Here are four reasons for the authenticity of this revision. Number one, many of the words in this revision are difficult to ascribe to a Christian writer. Christians didn't use these terms like Josephus did. Second, the grammar fits with Josephus. Josephus uses this language in this revised version. This fits with his grammar. Third, this fits with our understanding of Josephus, i.e., the fact that he's not a believer. Nothing in that revised version is questionable at all. That fits with what we know about him. And fourth, Josephus mentioned Jesus briefly in chapter 20. Remember, Jesus, who was called the Christ, makes us wonder if maybe he was brought up earlier. Let's go to our boy, Bart Ehrman, critic. This is from his book, Did Jesus Exist? Where he answers, of course he did. He says it's far more likely that the core of the passage actually does go back to Josephus himself. Even Ehrman believes that the core of this passage in Antiquities chapter 18 goes back to Josephus. The version that we have, if you pick up a copy of Josephus, was probably interpolated, distorted, but the core, that revision, goes back to him. Okay, so Josephus mentions James. He mentions Jesus. Now, that's disputed, but even Ehrman thinks that the core goes back to Josephus. He doesn't think Josephus was a believer. But guess who else Josephus mentions in chapter 18? John the Baptist. Check this out. Now, some of the Jews thought that it was God who had destroyed Herod's army and that it was a very just punishment to avenge John, surnamed the Baptist. John had been put to death by Herod, although he was a good man who exhorted the Jews to practice virtue, to be just one to another and pious toward God, and to come together by baptism. Baptism, he taught, was acceptable to God, provided they underwent it not to procure remission of sins, but for the purification of the body. If the soul had already been purified by righteousness. Isn't that what John the Baptist talks about? Matthew 3, that having good deeds in keeping with repentance. Josephus writes, because of this suspicion on Herod's part, John was sent in chains to the fortress of Machaerus and there put to death. The Jews therefore thought that the destruction of Herod's army was the punishment deliberately sent upon him by God to avenge John. So Josephus not only mentions John, gives a pretty good description of him, but he says he was also killed by Herod. Okay, then we have the Babylonian Talmud. This is not a very strong historical source because it's late dated and there's problems with it. But let's read from the Babylonian Talmud. It's codified in Babylon rather than Palestine. That's why it's the Babylonian Talmud. Dated sometime between the 3rd and 5th century. These are actually hard to nail down. In Sanhedrin 43a, we read, on the eve of Passover, okay, Christmas Eve is the day before Christmas. Passover Eve is the day before Passover, so Friday before, Good Friday, Yeshua was hanged. Yeshua is Jesus' name, Yeshua. He was hanged. Galatians 3:13 says that Christ was hanged. This is just a euphemism for crucifixion. Well, it says, for 40 days before the execution took place, a herald went forth and cried, he is going forth to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy. What's interesting here is, this is why it's kind of difficult to use as a historical source. They're trying to take credit for Jesus' death in this section of the Babylonian Talmud, whereas we know that the Romans were the ones responsible. But in this section of the Babylonian Talmud, they're trying to say they were going to kill him. Well, it's interesting that they said that they're going to stone him, going to stone Jesus. Well, Matthew 12 says that they were going to try and stone him. Why? Because he was being empowered by Satan to perform miracles. In this passage, it says that they're going to stone him because he practiced sorcery, satanic empowerment, and enticed Israel away. They thought that Jesus was taking the nation of Israel away from Yahweh. You know, in John 8, when Jesus blasphemed, they were going to pick up stones and kill him. Well, it says, anyone who can say anything in his favor, let him come forward and plead on his behalf. But since nothing was brought forward in his favor, he was hanged on the eve of Passover. So apparently Jesus was hanged. He was killed. Why? Because he performed miracles and he was empowered by Satan. And he was trying to take away the Jews from the living God. And yet it says that no one came on his behalf to his trial. No one supported him in his trial. Later, in Sanhedrin 107, we read that it was Jesus the Nazarene who practiced magic and led Israel astray. So it's not just Yeshua, it's Yeshua the Nazarene, specifically talking about Jesus. Okay, I know this is a lot of sources, but there's just a lot of people who talk about Christ at this time. Here's Lucian, second century satirist. This would be like the second century SNL. He's describing Christians. He describes them as the waste spewing out of Antioch into the rest of the world. He hated Christianity. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. OK, so Jesus was crucified. Christians worship this crucified man. You see, these misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they are immortal for all time, which explains their contempt for death. Is he a believer? No. These misguided creatures, they're stupid. I don't believe in them at all. These misguided creatures start with the general conviction that they're immortal. They have eternal life. That must explain why they don't mind going to their death for Christ. Then he says, voluntary self-devotion, which are so common among them, and then it was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers. Wouldn't you love if one of your enemies talked about you that way? The early Christian community had self-devotion, voluntary. They called one another brothers. From the moment that they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. So when does conversion happen? In a moment. Happens instantly. When you deny the gods of Greece and you believe in the true and living God and you worship this crucified teacher and start following after him. All this they take quite on works. No, all this they take quite on faith, with the result that they despise all worldly goods alike, regarding them merely as common property. This goes right in line with Acts 2, Acts 4, that they were sharing their possessions with the poor and the needy. Bart Ehrman describes this entire thing. He says there's absolutely nothing to suggest that the pagan Tacitus or the Jewish Josephus acquired their information about Jesus by reading the Gospels. In other words, these sources didn't come from them picking up Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and writing their history. They got their information separately, which is interesting because they're writing the exact same facts that we have in the New Testament. Now, just imagine for a moment if you were on trial in a court of law, and you had three of your friends come up and back up your alibi. Okay, that'd be pretty good. That'd be a pretty good array of witnesses to back you up. Now imagine if you had three of your enemies come up on trial in a court of law and back up your same exact alibi. The validation, the witness testimony of enemies boosts your historical reliability. Okay, so what would we know about Jesus apart from the New Testament? Let's just say we lit a match, we burn up every Bible on earth and all the church fathers that quote it and anyone else who's ever written, taught, or done anything with the New Testament. Let's just burn all that up. What would we know about Jesus apart from any Christian author? Well, from the Talmud, we'd know that Jesus was put on trial by his enemies for being a miracle worker who led the people of Israel astray. From Tacitus and Lucian, we would know that Christ was crucified during the reign of Emperor Tiberius, which is backed up by Luke 3:1. From Tacitus and Josephus, we would know that Christ was put to death by the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, which is backed up in Luke 23:24. From the Talmud, we would learn that Jesus was killed on the night before Passover. From Tacitus, we would learn that after his death, the superstition about Christ broke out originally in Judea around Jerusalem, but it made its way to Rome, as the book of Acts records. From Suetonius, we would know that Christianity was so controversial that Emperor Claudius kicked all the Jews out of Rome, and that the Jews in Rome were literally rioting over the person of Crestus by AD 49. That's right. This happened in AD 49, not 54. The edict was rescinded in AD 54. That's when he let the Jews come back in. The original edict was in AD 49. From Lucian and Pliny the Younger, we would learn that despite rampant persecution and torture, Jesus was worshipped as God by his followers. They believed he was divine, even though he was nailed to a cross. From Pliny the Younger, we would learn that the Christian faith was considered a contagious movement, even by the enemies of Christianity. And from Pliny, Suetonius, and Tacitus, we would learn that Christianity infiltrated all ages, social classes, and both genders. It was an immense group of people, not just a small class or subculture. It's no wonder that historians believe that the Christian movement reached 1 million people by the end of the first century. This was an explosive movement coming out of Jerusalem. From Josephus, we would learn that James was the brother of Jesus, and he was martyred for his faith in Christ, which is also backed up in the Bible. From Lucian, we learned that Christians met frequently, shared all things in common, believed that they would live after death, and they worshiped their crucified leader. Number 7, the trustworthiness of the disciples. Can we trust the disciples? Can we trust the disciples? How do we know that the disciples were reliable authors of the New Testament? Let's just string together everything we've learned tonight into this final section. This is kind of the culmination of everything we've studied. Can we trust the disciples? Here are 7 reasons to trust the disciples. The first reason is that the disciples were backed up by predictive prophecy of which they were unaware. No, last week we studied that the Daniel 9 prophecy was never once quoted by the New Testament authors. They make vague allusions to it. Luke 19:41-44, Jesus says that you will be judged because you did not recognize the time of my coming. Jesus quotes Daniel 9:27. But the messianic portion of Daniel 9, never once quoted. This implies that the disciples were not making this up, for if they were self-fulfilling these prophecies, wouldn't they have quoted that passage at least once? They're backed up by predictive prophecy that, I shouldn't say that they were unaware of, but that they couldn't fulfill. They couldn't have self-fulfilled. Number 2, the disciples get the details right in regards to history and archaeology. You know, imagine if a husband went away on a business trip. He comes home and his suspicious wife meets him at the door and she says, "I'm sure you were cheating on me this weekend. I know you were with another woman." And he says, "Honey, I wasn't cheating on you." And she says, "Well, where were you?" He says, "Well, I was in Chicago at a business meeting at the Marriott Hotel. I checked in Friday night. I checked out Sunday morning. I ate at the Applebee's for all 3 meals Saturday. I was at the seminar for 3 different sessions. And I was with my partner Bill at night. I swear, baby, take me back. Don't leave me." Well, she goes into his bag and his suitcase and opens it up. And what she finds is stolen towels from the Marriott Hotel and stolen soap bars from the Marriott Hotel. And she finds receipts from the Applebee's dated at 10 a.m., 2 p.m., and 7 p.m. And she finds notes passed back and forth between Bill and her husband during the seminar. And she finds packets from the seminar in the suitcase as well. Now, would that prove that the man did not have an affair on his wife? Well, it wouldn't prove it. We couldn't prove that from those facts. But it does validate his story, doesn't it? the places where she could investigate and check, checked out. And so that would help boost the rest of his story. How different would it be if he couldn't back up the rest of his story with those details? She'd have to take that on blind faith. Well, because she can verify these things that are able to be verified, it helps her believe in him with the rest of the story. Well, the same thing is true with the disciples. They get the areas right that we can verify. We might not be able to investigate their spiritual claims directly, but the fact that we can check them on the things that can be checked and they check out, that helps boost their credibility. Third, the disciples record embarrassing details about themselves. Boy, this is an understatement. Mark 9:32 records that the disciples were unintelligent and uneducated. Acts 4:13, it says that they were uneducated, unskilled, untutored. Mark 14:32, it says that the disciples were uncaring. They're kind of cold. Matthew 26:33 says that they were cowardly. These guys were sissies. They abandoned Jesus. Matthew 28:17, the verse right before the Great Commission. Not many people notice what this verse says. It says that some of them were bowing down and worshiping him, but it says, but others were doubtful. You're looking at the resurrected Christ raised from the dead, and some people were doubting. Is that really him? Not sure. They're unbelieving, they're cowardly, they're uncaring, uneducated, unintelligent. In fact, Jesus even calls Peter Satan in one account. Mark 8:33 calls him Satan. Guess who supervised the Gospel of Mark? Peter. Think about this. The disciples were the ones writing the story, and they record embarrassing details about themselves. The disciples place women at the empty tomb in all four Gospels. The first witnesses at the empty tomb, women. Josephus says, let not the testimony of a woman be counted on. Women couldn't testify in a court of law in this time. You know, if the disciples felt the freedom just to screw with the story, why wouldn't they make themselves the first eyewitnesses at the empty tomb? Why would you ever place women as the first eyewitnesses at the empty tomb? Now, this would be like if you were in a Mississippi courtroom in 1863 and you got brought in there for stealing horses, okay? And you did it. You stole the horses and go into the courtroom and you hire a hotshot attorney and you tell the attorney, hey, I stole these horses, but please go and advocate for my case. OK, I'll pay you good money. Get me off on this case. The attorney says, no problem. I'll go out and get some witnesses and we'll make up a story and we'll get you out of this thing. Well, Monday morning, you show up to court and in the Mississippi courtroom in 1863, you find that your hotshot attorney brought in three black witnesses off of the plantation field. At that time, in that culture, in that place, those people had no place in a court of law. They were viewed as subhuman. Their testimony was viewed as trash, as rubbish. You know, if you were making up the story, why wouldn't you go get some other witnesses that were viewed at the time as important? That's what it would be like if the disciples were placing women at the empty tomb. It's an embarrassing detail. They wouldn't write it that way unless it actually happened that way. A conspirator wouldn't make up a story like that. Only a historian would. They also note that Sanhedrinists buried the body of Jesus. John 19:38 records that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, two members of the Sanhedrin, buried Jesus' body. Now, in the early Christian literature, the Christians hated the Jewish Sanhedrin. Well, why? Well, Mark 14:55 says that all the council of the Sanhedrin voted for Jesus to be killed. So in other words, what this is here is that the disciples were saying that the enemies of Christianity took Jesus's body and buried him in a nice tomb. Why would you write the story that way, that the enemies were the ones who did the good deed? unless it actually turned out that way. Okay, let me put another spin on that. If you were trying to figure out that Jesus never rose from the dead, the first person you would go to is who? The guy who buried the body, Joseph of Arimathea. And yet the Christians put his name in their account, saying, actually, we're going to put the credibility of our story in this guy's hands. This would be like today saying you committed murder and you made up an alibi. And in the alibi, you said, you know, I have two United States senators who are with me at a hotel the time when I supposedly killed that person. Okay, if you were making up the names of the senators, you'd be immediately invalidated. So let's say they're making up the name Joseph of Arimathea. He never lived. People would know that he never existed. The members of the Sanhedrin were the rock stars of the time. They were the known people. It'd be like walking up to somebody and saying, you know, Ted Bundy, our president right now. No, Barack Obama is president, you idiot. You're making that up. Okay, so you're giving the credibility of your story into the hands of two notable people. If you were making it up, you could go to those people and invalidate it very quickly. Fourth, the disciples record embarrassing details about Jesus. The disciples record embarrassing details about Jesus. Not only do they record embarrassing details about themselves and their story, they record embarrassing details about their leader. If you were writing the story, why write it that way? If you were a conspirator, why would you write the story that way? They said that Jesus was considered insane. Mark 3:21. He was considered deceitful. John 7:12. His enemies even called him drunk. Matthew 11:19. Demon possessed. Mark 3:22. His family said he must have a demon. John 7, his brothers didn't even believe in him. If you were a conspirator, if you were making up the story, why write it that way? They included Jesus' disputed and difficult teachings, which were and are quite confusing. If you read through the teaching of Jesus, sometimes it's just downright confusing. Why include teachings that are difficult for then and now, if you're making up the story? Fifth, the disciples did not feel the freedom to put words in Jesus' mouth. The disciples didn't feel the freedom to place words on Jesus' lips. This is actually an interesting point. Think about this for a second. You know, the early church disagreed a lot about circumcision. They disagreed a lot about how much they had to obey the law. They disagreed about speaking in tongues. They disagreed about the woman's role in the church and the relationship between Jews and Gentiles. Why doesn't Jesus in the four Gospels address any of those issues? You know, if you were an early leader in the early church and you had a problem about circumcision, wouldn't it be nice just to be like, we could add a verse or two about Jesus talking about this. It's needed or it's not needed. Jesus never mentions it. They didn't feel the freedom to do that. Why wouldn't he mention something about Jews and Gentiles? Jesus says, I actually just came for the house of Israel. That's my goal. He said that you should go out into the ends of the earth. But they didn't feel the freedom to put words on Jesus' lips. That shows integrity. Sixth, the disciples founded their faith on the resurrection. The disciples founded their faith on the resurrection. This is incredibly odd when you study it. N.T. Wright, a scholar whom I don't really like very much, but who's credible in this area on the resurrection. N.T. Wright has an 800-page tome, a massive work, called The Resurrection of the Son of God. It came out in 2003, where he documents how concepts of resurrection did not exist before the time of Christ. In Judaism, you have a few throwaway allusions to resurrection. You've got Isaiah 26:19, Ezekiel 37, Daniel 12:2, maybe Job 19 as well. But it's just very, it's a very small concept in Judaism. Judaism didn't really teach on the resurrection very much. It said that everyone at the end of human history is going to be resurrected. The concept of resurrection didn't come from Judaism, didn't come from the Hebrew Bible, nor did it come from paganism. The Gentile world didn't have a concept for resurrection. I'll give you a few reasons why. The Gentile world, Greco-Roman thought, believed in kind of a Neoplatonic thinking, like New Plato thinking. They believed that the solar spirit was bifurcated, was different from the body or the flesh. So the notion that when you died, your soul and spirit would leave your body, which was considered to be evil, would go up to heaven and then would come back into a decaying, filthy, stinky corpse and be resurrected was just unthinkable. To a Greco-Roman, when your solar spirit, which was thought to be pure, left the body, it was on a one-way ticket to the afterlife. It did not come back into the body because the body was thought of as filthy. Resurrection was not popular among the pagans. That's why in Acts 17:32, Paul goes in and starts talking to the Greeks. And when he gets to the subject of resurrection, they cut him off, scoff, and kick him out of the agora. Well, the question is, if resurrection didn't come from Judaism and it didn't come from paganism, then where did it come from? This must have been inaugurated. It must have began with Christ. Now, some people say, well, it was a hallucination. It was something like that. But any way you look at it, they founded their faith on this idea that Jesus had been raised and that we too would be raised as well. Seventh and finally, the disciples went to their deaths and led others to their deaths for their beliefs. While other religions or worldviews have grown rapidly through the threat of violence, the Christian faith grew under the threat of violence. You see, that's a pretty big distinction. Other worldviews have spread underneath the sword, at the end of a barrel of a gun. Christianity, for the first three centuries at least, grew under the threat of violence, torture, and death. If you convert, you would be tortured. Remember Suetonius? Remember Pliny? Remember Tacitus? They describe how the Christians were exploding even though they were being tortured and killed. Persecution, in other words, gave no reason to believe in Jesus and every reason not to believe in him. And yet this movement still exploded. The disciples each went to their deaths. Jesus' closest disciples each went to torturous deaths in their belief in him. Peter was crucified upside down. Paul was beheaded. James was stoned to death. Okay, they went to their deaths. Why not just recant? Why not just say, you know, actually, we made the whole thing up. We lied. We made the entire thing up. Well, the fact that they went to their deaths doesn't prove the veracity of their belief, but it does prove the sincerity of their belief. Okay, a lot of people go to their deaths for their religion or worldview. That doesn't make it true, but it does mean that they're sincere, doesn't it? They did sincerely believe that. Now, sincerity does not mean truth, but at least it shows that these guys were sincere in what they believed. Put that another way, while religious fanatics will go to their deaths for what they believe to be the truth, the disciples would have gone to their deaths for what they knew to be a lie. And that's the difference. They would have known, we made this whole thing up. We lied. We said there was an empty tomb and there wasn't. We stole the body or we did whatever. They would have been doing that knowing this is a complete hoax. Now, what's the odds that you'd have that many people separated that were closest to Jesus, tortured and killed without one of them recanting and saying, you know what, this whole thing was completely made up. You know, I remember when I was a kid and we'd get in trouble, we'd get separated and they'd put the squeeze on me and my sister. And whichever one of us ratted each other out first was the one that didn't get spanked or whatever. Well, same thing is true with these guys. You know, you think about five guys getting brought in by the cops. They say, you know, your buddy's already broken over there. You might as well come through and confess. What are the odds that one of these guys wouldn't have come through and said this whole thing was made up? Here's the way Kenneth Lauderette writes about it in his History of Christianity. He says, never in the history of the race has this record ever quite been equaled. Never in so short a time has any other religious faith, or for that matter, any other set of ideas, religious, political, or economic, without the aid of physical or of social cultural prestige, achieved so commanding a position in such an important culture. You know, other views have spread fast, perhaps even faster. Communism spread very fast. And yet it was because there was physical force involved. I don't think anyone would deny that. Or there's social or cultural pressure. And yet Christianity spread actually against the tide of physical force and social and cultural prestige. Well, I left us some time after all, 15 minutes. Any questions before we close up? Yeah. N.T. Wright, question is, why don't I like N.T. Wright? N.T. Wright, as one pastor put it, gets the resurrection right, but he gets the cross wrong. And his view of atonement, which is just the concept that we could be made right with God through the death of Christ, he holds to a new perspective on Paul, is what it's called. In Romans chapters 1 through 3, Paul is not talking about working our way to God through good works of the law. Instead, when Paul says, through the works of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, what Paul means is no works of the Torah. And by that he means, by being a Jew, you can't be made right with God. So when Paul's describing that both the Gentiles and the Jews can come to faith in Yeshua, Christ, he's not talking about being forgiven by God. What he's saying is that sociologically, both the Jews and the Gentiles can now be in the family of God together. And that's what the message of Romans 1 through 3 is all about, which I find to be absolutely asinine. I can't believe you would hold that view. You have to reinterpret, put a whole new lens on the entire New Testament to think that. And he's got some kind of wacky views on eschatology, too. But his stuff on the atonement, I think, is really, really, really bad. So, but as a historian, he's very sharp. So, yeah, it's a good question. Oh, yeah, over here. That's a great point. So under the pressure, when people are being pressured, they sing like a bird. And yet in this situation, they didn't. That's a great point. Yeah. I thought you were going to ask which of the 11 verses weren't quoted. I don't know that. The two books that weren't quoted by Ignatius, Polycarp, or Clement are 2 Peter and Jude. And Paul Barnett, in his book on the historicity of the New Testament, just says that they probably just didn't have access to these books. The fact that these were being spread all throughout the ancient world probably just means that they didn't have access to Jude or 2 Peter, especially when you consider that 2 Peter was addressed to the Christians in Bithynia, where Christianity had a late start. And Jude was to a very specific audience. Actually, the audience of Jude is disputed. We don't really know where it was written to. And so it wasn't that these weren't around. It's just that they didn't have access to them in the first century. Yeah. Okay, the question is, why is there debate on some of the authorship of Paul's letters? The arguments against Paul's authorship are usually literary. So for the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus, there's language in those letters that Paul doesn't use in the rest of his other letters. Okay. And so from that, they conclude, well, this must have been written by another author because the words in the pastorals aren't used in the other letters. Paul wrote those at the end of his life. How many people here are going to write the same today as they would when they're 20 or 30 years older than now? Galatians in 49 AD is not going to read the same as 1st or 2nd Timothy, written in the mid-60s AD. That's 20 years later. Moreover, Paul is usually writing to a vast audience, a church. In the pastoral epistles, he's writing to an individual person. Now, if you were to write a letter to Xenos Christian Fellowship, to every person here, Wouldn't that sound different than if you were writing to your friend Joe, who you knew personally or whoever? And then there's other arguments that in the pastorals we have leadership criteria in Titus 1 and in 1 Timothy 3. And they argue that the notion that there were leaders in the first century church is not true, and that leadership criteria didn't come into the second and third centuries. So this idea that there are leadership criteria is probably because this was written later. And yet there are leaders mentioned in the book of Acts. It says in Acts 14 that there were elders and deacons. And even the leadership criteria is so loose in 1 Timothy 3. It's just character criteria. And it's kind of a short list when you think about it. So I just don't think that the literary arguments are very good. But it's usually word count. And I just don't think those arguments are very strong. Yeah. Okay, so the question is, what about when you've got these later Christians who got into bed with the state and Christianized the country, Christianized the empire, and then they started to go through and Christianize people by force? Well, in the first three centuries, Christianity actually had its greatest explosion. In the first century, when the disciples were still alive, it went from 500 people to a million, which is 2,000-fold growth. Just think, if you went from a million times 2,000, that'd be, 2 billion. That'd be more people than there were on earth. So actually, Christianity grew the fastest before there was anyone in a kind of a top-down situation who was able to force people to convert to Christ. It actually grew slower when Christianity got into bed with the state, not faster. And we could just say, when people force conversions and do kind of cruel things like that, all we can say is on other worldviews, that might be consistent with what the worldview teaches. But at least with our worldview, that's not what we teach. That's not what Jesus taught. He said that we should persuade others, but not coerce others, not force others. So we would just say that's not what Christ taught. And Jesus said you have to recognize false teachers from true teachers by recognizing their fruit. Matthew 7. So that's a good question. Yeah, sure. OK, how many Jameses are there is the question, I think. James of Zebedee, James and John. John, who wrote Revelation, the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, is John of Zebedee. His brother is James of Zebedee. He dies in Acts 12:2. He's killed. That's the one to whom Jesus said in Mark 10, "You want to sit at my right hand and my left? Can you undergo the baptism with which I am going to undergo?" Meaning suffering. And so he says, you will learn eventually. Well, James of Zebedee was killed in Acts 12. The one who wrote the epistle, James, to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, that's James, the brother of Jesus. That's who we think that James is there, because he doesn't identify himself as James of Zebedee, and for a litany of other reasons. But that James is mentioned in Galatians 1:19. I went up to Jerusalem 3 years later, met with James, the brother of Jesus. And then in Galatians 2, he's mentioned again. Then in Acts 15, three chapters after James of Zebedee was killed, James, the brother of Jesus, is at the Council of Jerusalem. And then in Acts 21, James, the brother of Jesus, is called the pillar of the church. He's the leader in the church of Jerusalem. He really ministered to the Jewish people there. So really just think there's two Jameses, but there's two others that are kind of not that important. Well, you guys want to pray? Any last questions? We made it halfway through. You guys should all come back for part two next week. Cool. Let's pray now.